Today we revisit Series 4 with Jonathan Luwaga. In this episode, Jonathan shares his journey from childhood surgery to male fertility advocate. Jonathan talks about breaking down cultural barriers and redefining what fatherhood means. His message is simple. Be honest with yourself, but most of all, be kind to yourself.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode. We're really excited because we're in good company. We're joined by a fellow male fertility advocate, Jonathan Luwaga. It's great to have you here, Jonathan. Thanks for coming.
Well, thank you for having me, guys. Yeah, I'm grateful and happy to be on the Male Fertility Podcast.
Yeah, we've been trying to get it sorted for a long time. We love your story and how you portray it and how you say it, and we want to share that as far and wide as we can. So let's get into it. What's brought you here and what do you now do with that voice that you've created?
I'd want to start off by, you know, just giving a little introduction about myself. And I'm from London, originally from Uganda in East Africa. I'm from a family of seven. I have three brothers, three sisters. I'm one half of a twin as well. We came here when I was 1 year old with my family. My story with fertility actually started at the age of 14. I had undetermined testicles, so I had to go for a procedure at that time. I was playing football with the guys and then the ball hit me in the groin area and I fell. And then the doctor saw me and told my parents that basically my testicles were missing and had to go for a procedure to get them put back into the scrotum.
That must have been a hard kick by the football.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Send them right back up.
Literally. I don't know whether that kick actually set them back up or they're already up. No one ever really explained that to me or to my parents. And then obviously, 20 plus years later, when I get into a relationship, that's when it all begun, of finding out that it could have had an impact on my fertility. That's how it started. So me and my, unfortunately, who's now my ex-girlfriend, we were trying to have a baby for a couple of years and then it just didn't work for us. As naive as I was, I pushed her to go and get herself tested. I didn't really think much that it would affect me. And then she went and got tested, went to see a gynecologist privately, and it was all good. They said her body was working perfectly fine, and then the attention turned to me. I remember the gynecologist said to me, I think you need to get tested. And now there's certain words and there's certain reactions and there's certain moods that you just never forget. I'm sure you guys know it yourself, but the way she just said, you've got to get tested, and it's like a point. It's like I'm a bad boy.
The tone of her voice was
completely off. And then called my doctor, and my doctor was very much, he called me in, explained how long we've been trying for, blah, blah. He said, oh, Jonathan, I see you got undetermined testicles. I'm like, yeah. He's like, oh, okay, yeah. Okay, I'm going to give you an appointment. Come in to see me. And then he went in. He done the invasive examination. Told me to strip naked. And just basically, yeah, he started doing what he had to do and just check to see what was wrong. And then he was like, I can't see. There's nothing I can see that's going to be a real issue. Obviously, undetermined testicles may cause a problem, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to transfer to a urologist. And I was like, okay, fine. And he was like, good luck.
Is that what he said?
Yeah, good luck.
It's definitely not what you want to hear when you've just gone to see someone that's supposed to be helping you. You don't want a good luck. You want a, this is the treatment plan.
Yes. Exactly. And then, yeah, from there, we just moved on and went. I spoke with a urologist and she told me the first thing that I have to do is to go for a semen analysis. And I remember going into that room and being sat in that room. It was just after COVID. Mm. And obviously everyone's social distancing and there were so many men and everyone's kind of heads are down. No one's looking at each other. And I was with my girlfriend. I was the only one that was with my girlfriend at the time. And I just put my head down. She's looking at me and she's like, you're right. She kept tapping me. She's like, are you okay? It's just awkward. And because I think we all knew what we were there for.
Yeah.
And no one, I'm not saying, oh, we've got to be like, you know, we've got to talk away and be like, oh, hi, what are you here for?
Yeah. Oh, it's your first time. Come here often. None of it. But I get what you mean. It's when I first had my first semen analysis, just that sitting in the waiting room, you're not knowing what's coming. You're literally left with a pot
and told to go to a room where you're told your whole life you've been told you can't do this in public.
Exactly.
How did you find that first experience actually in the room?
They just gave you a magazine and they said there's Wi-Fi if you need the Wi-Fi and yeah, just go and do what you need to do. Yeah. For me, it was like I sat in that room for about, I was in it actually for a good half an hour.
Hmm.
Really just couldn't do it. One, I just couldn't get myself to the level of excitement.
Yeah.
The show is real, isn't it?
Yeah, pressure was immense. And then I'd done it, but nothing came out. I remember leaving the room and giving it to the clinical nurse. And I said, look, there's my cup. She's like, oh, there's nothing in there. I'm like, yeah, there's nothing in there. She goes, okay, we need to come back in 2 weeks to complete another one. I was like, oh, okay. For me, it was just like, no problem. And then I came back 2 weeks later and it was the same thing. There was nothing there. They told me to come back maybe a month and a bit later to do another one. And then, yeah, that's when the urologist says, okay, look, let me discuss with you the next steps for this. And she tried retrograde masturbation. So she just made me, instead of masturbating, she told me to either masturbate or have sex. And once I finished having sex or masturbating, to then go do a urine sample to see if it goes back into my system rather than coming out.
Yeah.
That was like the fourth time. Mm. And that was the fourth one. And then she examined the urine sample and I saw that there's no retrograde masturbation. It's not going back into the system. So the next step was to just go for a flexible cystoscopy. And it was just like a small camera inserted through my penis. And yeah, they just wanted to see. That was tense because I was in a room with someone just putting a small camera at my penis.
Yeah, man, I can imagine. That's a different level of uncomfortableness.
Yes, yeah, it was very uncomfortable. Yeah.
Both emotionally, but also physically, I would imagine.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't envy you with that one, that's for sure. I think every bloke listening now will be wincing a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, to be fair, I was grateful that happened because I was like, okay, she's actually wanting to find out what's going on and if there's any blockages. And then that came out, there was nothing for them to see. That was a major problem. And then it was like, let's go and try a prostate MRI. And then, yeah, prostate was pretty normal. And then the next, they asked me to go for a testicles ultrasound. And that's when they discovered that I had testicles that were 3 times smaller than the average male. After the testicles ultrasound, she actually done an examination where she actually had to make sure that I had the tubing and the lining that connects from the scrotum to the testicles to make sure that the lining is there so that it's the sperm line, apparently. I don't know the clinical word for it, but you had to make sure there's a line that was there. But it took her quite a long time to actually fill that line because he said it was quite thin in comparison to other men. Even men that may have other low sperm count, they still have a thicker line. My one's quite thin. And then she said that the next step is to go for a rigid cystoscopy. Basically, is to go under a knife, open up my penis wider, put a larger camera down there, and to make sure they haven't missed anything. I think that was the toughest point.
Wow, mate. What really stood out to me there is all these hurdles, all these procedures, all the waiting as well. You're constantly pushing on and doing it. But it just shows your like absolute grit and determination to push on and find answers and undergo these investigations and procedures. Absolutely hats off to you and like, fair play because you kept picking yourself up and going again.
Yeah, yeah. Don't get wrong, Sean, it was tough. Mentally, I knew what the next step was because they were telling me what the next step was, but actually having to just to process the next step and be like, all right, okay, fine. Explain the fact that you're going to have a rigid cystoscopy and you're going to have a catheter after that, after the cystoscopy, and you're going to have to be wearing a catheter for about 2 weeks. And I was like, catheter? I have to wean a bag for 2 weeks? It's crazy. It was, yeah.
Yeah, man, it's such a lot to go through. Mm. An incredible amount. The one thing I do take from that is that they certainly did a thorough examination. Each time they knew what the treatment plan would be, Because quite often we talk to guys and they have a semen analysis and it's not a good outcome from that, and they're pushed straight onto another pathway without any real examination going on.
Yeah.
Were you offered any emotional support through it all?
No. I had to pick myself up after each procedure or each examination. I think the most challenging part was not so for myself, but it was more so for my partner at the time. That was the challenging part, because having to deal with her emotions and her feelings and how it affected me. And yeah, that was the toughest part.
Yeah, it's hard both ways, isn't it? Because you, I'd imagine, would have been feeling a lot of guilt as well, having so-called, quote-unquote, put her through it. But of course, like, it's nothing is by your choice, because I struggle with those feelings as well.
Yeah.
That, oh, I can't give you what you want. And it's hard, isn't it? And at the same time, you're still struggling with your own feelings and emotions, but then trying to be strong and carry on, get through the next invasive procedure. So, yeah. So how did you navigate those feelings, like internally within yourself and externally with your partner?
Two things. I'm a man of faith. I believe in God. So that kind of pushed me through, one. And two, also my positive outlook. I always said to myself, look, they'll find something. That's why I just told myself first and foremost. And then I tried to relay that back to her. And yeah, I was just trying to, like, the self-help books to help with my like mental well-being. And I try to surround myself with people that are a bit more positive. I'm going through such a negative situation. So surrounding myself with people that are a bit more positive allowed me to have a bit more positive outlook on life. But as things progressed, it got a bit more difficult to maintain that, because it's like I'm getting bad news after bad news. So yeah, so that was like a real struggle. But like I said, just a man of faith and trying to have that positive outlook. And for my partner, I think we struggled because this whole stigma, men don't talk, men do not talk. And I fell into that bracket of men don't talk. It was like, I kept myself to myself. I avoided communicating about the situation, about what I'm going through. I avoided explaining about how I'm feeling. But then I wasn't always asked about how I'm feeling. So I just internalized a lot of stuff, and it made me a bit more stressed, especially with work. And I became very quiet. Despondent with people, and you know, became a bit frustrated, even became ill, got on tablets for thyroid problem, because I was so stressed with the journey.
Yeah, I think that's a very common thing, mate, that you shut down initially.
Yeah,
I believe it's part of the processing. Mm. As a man, I'm not just going to sit and talk pointlessly about something that emotionally that I'm feeling. If I've thought about it and had time to process it, I now know that I can articulate how I feel about things, but I didn't feel like that back then. Do you think that you struggled with that initial conversation? If you really look back now with a level-headed mind, more experience in terms of your ability to process, because that's clear because you're so open about talking about it now, what do you think was the reason behind it?
Shame. Of course, she had a child already.
Right.
From a previous relationship. Her daughter will treat me like a real father, and I'll treat her like a real daughter. So it was a struggle, because we were wanting to, when she asked us questions, or when are you having a baby? When are we having a sibling? I'll look at her mom and the mom would look at me and just be like, I actually don't know when we're going to have a sibling. The main thing was just a shame. I just felt shame. And also the support network. I didn't know where to find the men who are going through the same thing as me.
I think everybody that we've spoken to has talked about that loneliness.
Mm.
It is why we started the podcast, and it's why we've now started Nexus. It's the fact of, it's a horrendous feeling.
Oh.
And the only way you can describe it is deep loneliness and just deep sadness. Like sadness is a real thing. At some points, I couldn't explain it any other way to my wife. I'm just sad. I'm deeply sad. Yeah. And that is, once again, part of the processing phase. It's the first step of coming to terms with something, rather than the initial denial, it has not happened to me.
Yeah.
It kicks in and suddenly you're sad because you have the realization. But I completely emphasize there, and I'm sure Sean does, in terms of that feeling of shame. You don't know where to find someone to talk to.
Yeah.
And two, if you did, you don't know actually how to start that conversation.
For me, it was a loss of identity. Who am I? What is my purpose? When we're younger, I want to have a big car and a nice house and I want to have, you know, 5 kids. In reality, I was like, I have to grieve all of that. Grieve the fact that, will I ever be a father? And naturally, and yeah. Then you learn about having to be a partner, having to do IVF and having to navigate that. Does she want to do IVF? Is IVF for her? Those are also things that I was questioning myself, having to research, does she want to do this? Is medicated? Do you want to do it? And my ex-partner, unfortunately, she don't want to do it because she was quite skeptical of the medicine that they're being injecting her with. And you can't force somebody.
That's hard. And like you said, you have to grieve because it's the loss of a dream and it's like a bubble being burst. It wasn't there, but it feels so real because you've built it up over years. And yes, to have to let go of that, it's a long process. So how did you start coming through that? Like you said, you got into self-help books and like your faith helped you. But what was the turning point for you? Is there any breadcrumbs that you could leave for other guys that be perhaps in that space now about how to start clawing your way out of it?
I think believing in myself a bit more. And because my partner really had a child, the fact that I was able to, as such, father a child that's not biologically mine, made the whole process a bit easier for me, because even I knew what it takes to be a father, what it takes to be a man, what it takes to have an influence on somebody's life. When they turn around and say to you, you inspire me, I love you, and you're this, you're that. Those are the things that kind of made me push on and be like, oh yeah, you're right. I don't necessarily have to have a child that's biologically mine for me to feel a sense of manhood. No, but me being present in her life and being a good role model in her life was enough. And that's what kind of pushed me to move on and actually keep going for the examinations and keep on persevering. Even though we had broken up, I just wanted to be like, you know what? I want to prove to myself that I can do this and actually find the end result without having to be reliant on other people.
Yeah, I think that's powerful, mate. Thank you. As a donor recipient father with no biological connection to my kids, it's about showing up. And that is more powerful than any DNA link.
Yeah.
Like that's almost taken for granted. People think they'll have that connection because of the DNA link, but in fairness, it's nonsense. And in terms of the loneliness and isolation you felt, do you think that there are any cultural or perhaps religious reasons that made that a level higher for you?
Yeah, of course, because I'm from Uganda and the idea of male fertility is just crazy to my culture. Even up until now, the blame is always on the woman, regardless if the man may have the issue. Having gone back to Uganda myself, having experienced it firsthand and seeing other men blame their partner when they've got the issue, it's like I just didn't really have the nuance and the words kind of explained to my father or explained to my brothers that, look, hey, I'm going through this fertility problem. Especially at the beginning, the only time I told them I was going through a fertility problem was a day before my rigid cystoscopy. And the only reason why I had to tell them was because I was going to go move back home, and because we didn't want my ex-girlfriend's daughter to see at the time what me weaning the bag. So I had to go back home, and that's when I revealed everything to everyone. And it was just like a real shock. Oh my God. It's just the expectation that men in Uganda or in Africa in general, the expectation that they can just produce and no one has any problems. And if the fertility is a problem, it's the female problem.
Is there any pressure to have larger families, like you mentioned, wanting 5 kids? Is that impressed upon you as well?
It's not pressed in terms of you need to have kids. But because I come from a big family, you naturally, in your mind, psychologically, you think, I need to have a big family.
Yeah.
I don't want to have 1 or 2 kids or 1 child and they're left by themselves and everyone else has got 3 or 4 siblings. So subconsciously, you always thought about that at a young age. You don't want to be the only one that doesn't have any kids. And I've got an uncle that doesn't have any kids. And whenever I look at him and I talk with him, I feel his hurt and his sadness. It's even for me, I feel like a sense of guilt for him. If only he had the resources that were available that I had to help him, maybe he might have had a better outcome. So yeah, but obviously him, there's a lot of blame as well. Unfortunately, it's because he didn't really understand that it could be a male problem as much as it is a female problem.
It's an interesting cultural view, isn't it? Because obviously in the Western world now, where we're understanding obviously the male side of things, but there are still parts of the world that it's not like that at all. No. In some aspects, you could say it's nowhere near it yet.
No.
How did your family react when you actually told them? Was there, you spoke about shock, but what was their initial reactions?
They just asked me, why didn't I speak up earlier? But I was worried about people's reaction. I don't know how to explain it to people that having fertility problems. I think my dad, unfortunately, his mindset has changed now because I speak a lot more about it. But the mindset before was like, you know, there's certain things we don't talk about. In our culture, we don't talk about sex. We never spoke about sex with my dad. Never had the birds and the bees talk. So if I can't talk about sex with him, how do I go talk about fertility? And with my mum, it's different as well because it's the same thing. But now I've understood a bit more, so I'm kind of more open-minded to a lot of things. But yeah, so it was difficult. But my twin brother and my other brothers, okay, so what's next? So how do we help you? I'm like, right now there's not much you can do for me because I'm going to go through a rigorous endoscopy. They're going to see if there's anything they've missed. And the other thing is having to, you know, we talk about culturally, the fact that after rigorous endoscopy, having to, where I live is that we don't have a shower, we have a bath. So right. After when I've run a catheter, I have to climb up. But my, which I don't blame him because my dad just didn't know like how to deal with this sort of thing. So he never really helped me with that. It was my mum that helped me with that. So my mum, I have to drop my ego, I have to emasculate myself and be like, look, my mum has, last time she's seen me naked was when I was a baby. But now I'm in my 30s and she's got to see me naked. And she's got to help me get into the bath. She cares and she wants to help me as much as she can. And that was the most challenging part, you know, having to get her to help me. And then when my brother would have to come round and help me get changed.
Mate, you've been through it, haven't you? Our things now with your family.
With my family, things are great. Things are amazing. They're always on my case about, if you don't find somebody and, you know, my sister, don't worry, you just get an egg, I'll carry it for you. Things have improved and I wouldn't say things were terrible. No, they've never been terrible, but it's just because I never really spoke about it. So I can't fault them for not thinking about certain things because I never spoke about it. But when I did, it's been improved. The way we speak and people have changed. I remember one time being out with my cousins and we're going out to a pub to watch football and we're talking about kids and I was like, never this conversation. There's a few guys that who I know, but I don't know. Anyway, and they were saying, oh man, everyone should have kids, man. I don't know, anyone can have kids. I'm having to deal with that. And that's the way you want to tell them, but you can't tell them, like, I have fertility problems. It's very insensitive what you're saying about people that can't naturally produce. It's very hurtful, but you don't know what to say. You don't know how to approach it. And then you're like, oh, so I just usually leave it. But now, because I speak about it, people are just like, oh, okay. It's made them more aware of what they're saying to me and how they're addressing me. Before, when me and my ex-girlfriend were together, they'll be like, when are you going to have kids? When are you guys going to have kids?
Yeah. We're in this society where people think it's okay to essentially ask when you're going to have sex with your partner.
I actually didn't even think about it that way, but that's actually so true.
Yeah, it's weird because it's accepted and it's an odd one, but that's the importance of what you're doing. By the awareness you're raising, it will mean that someone else never will meet, you're going to make it a little bit easier for them because they might not get asked that question from their friends or family.
Absolutely.
I found that when I came to the acceptance of everything that was going on, when people would ask us things like that, I just used to spill it all. Be like, well, you want the answer? Here's the answer. But you have to get to that point. Do you know what I mean? It's so hard to get to. And the amount of people that, when they apologize, deeply apologize for not for being insensitive, but then they don't know what else to say. Yes. People do need to think about what they're saying. We do live in a very open world, but there are still certain things that we as a society need to be aware are happening and just tread gently around certain subjects.
Can I ask, how did you get to that point where, you just spilt it and just tell them?
I think for me, it was just after I started having my therapy, where I'd been at my lowest, and I started creeping back up. It just got to the point that I was like, you know what, people keep asking me, so I'm going to give them the response that they're not expecting, and it's only the truth, and it's nothing outside of the truth. But if you're going to ask me a question, I'm going to tell you the truth now, because I'd spent so long covering it up, and it was exhausting. Mm-hmm. It just exhausted me, and I was just fed up of being exhausted, and I was processing it myself. And I remember distinctly it happened in the pub, and I was only drinking. I will highlight this. We were going through treatment at the time, and I was only drinking a Coke, but wasn't in the pub boozing it. But I just thought, you know what? I'm going to say it. And I said it. I was like, actually, we're currently going through a fertility cycle. We've been going on it for 3 years. It's male factor, so my wife's fine, but it's me. They don't know what it is. And I just ran with it. And you get some people don't know what to say sorry and quickly disappear. And then I've also had conversations with people that really lean into the conversation as well. Mm. And actually, they'll go, oh, yeah, that happened to my friend, that kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah, so I just lent into it. Nice. It's hard, though. It's really hard.
Yeah, it's a big step. And one that I think if people can take, it does start to fast forward that healing and finding a new version of yourself. Because, of course, there are people who will be doing it earlier. I'm absolutely not saying there's rights or wrong about this because everyone's different. But for people who have bottled it up for a long time, when you then do start spilling and opening up, I think then that starts to really move things forward. It's like you're putting that secrecy, that shame element of it to bed, coming out of it and putting it out there. This is a strong moment. And I remember doing it, and I've never been the same person since, for good reasons. Like, I was able to really start moving forward then. So I'd be interested to know who the Jonathan is today compared to the Jonathan back then, who was living in that silent, shame-based life.
I feel empowered because I get the opportunity. I'm grateful to the fact that I get to speak and meet you guys and your stories. And it's a reminder of that I was not alone. I just fortunately I wasn't able to meet you at that time. But now I've met you and hearing your stories, I feel stronger. I feel, like I said, I feel empowered to tell my story, help other men at whatever stage they're at. I feel like it's my duty to talk about my story and tell my story and help others. I feel confident within myself. One thing I've learned is that this journey doesn't define who I am. And I feel as if my journey hasn't actually even begun. I've still got to go through IVF. So I'm still evolving as a person. And I know the struggles, not firsthand, but from hearing other people's stories, I know the struggles of IVF. So I have to go through that journey myself as well with that. Yeah, I feel like I'm 10 times the person that I was 4 years ago. In terms of being shallow, naive, one, being quiet and not, I'm a really bad communicator. So now I've put my communication levels back up and been more confident within myself.
Brilliant. I think it shows the strength of your character now, the fact that you are sharing now. And like you've just said, you're not through it, you're still living it. So that really stands out to show, like, wow, because that is strength. Because you could quite justifiably be burying this still until you're on the other side, whatever the other side looks like.
Thankfully, I've managed to achieve sperm, so I'm able to go do ICSI. It's not guaranteed to work, so how do I deal with that?
Yeah. Do you know what you've been saying? It reminded me of a quote. It's a gold medal is a wonderful thing, but if you're not enough without it, you'll never be enough with it. So that sounds like it could come from, like, a Greek philosopher or something. It's actually from the film Cool Runnings.
Oh, and I love Cool Runnings.
Yeah. But I literally, it stopped me in my tracks earlier and I read it And the message is powerful because it's with fertility. I think it's like when you're going through infertility, you have to let go of that part of you. Like you said earlier, you build up this dream of the house, the cars, the kids, and you have to let go of that because you then have to rediscover who you are, build a new, stronger version of yourself. Otherwise, kids aren't going to change that if you were to get there. Like that is almost like just papering over more cracks and masking. You've really found out who you are and become that strongest version of yourself, which then arms you and equips you to thrive, not just through the fertility journey, but through life. And as you're saying, as a communicator, I honestly, you have my utmost respect for what you've been through and where you are.
I do want to just go back slightly, Jonathan. You talked about your faith.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not a religious guy, but my wife's family are. And it was one of our concerns in terms of how it would be received, in terms of would it be a positive and negative thing within the church? Because my wife grew up quite religious. The most support we got was from the church. It was amazing. And it was one of those places that I could go and I did feel at peace. Generally did during the whole thing. How was your experience? Because there will be guys listening to this who do have religious backgrounds and have faith. How was your experience?
To be honest, Kieran, I never really spoke about it to people within the church. I went to. I just went to church to pray for myself and pray for my journey and pray for my relationship. And just like you said, like you brilliantly said it, it gave me peace. When I walked in, I did the music and the songs and just made me feel very emotional, overwhelmed at times. But I was also a reminder of that. It's okay. Like for me, God is going to look after me. Like regardless of whether I get the sperm or don't get the sperm, I have to know that he's got the right direction for my life and he's given me the purpose to talk about my journey. So that's the most important thing. That my mom's quite faithful as well. So she told me, let's go to like places like Lourdes. Let's go to Rome. Yeah, let's go there and just go. Let's go and get blessings. Let's go and get blessed. Back then, I'd be laughing at her, like, oh, I'm not doing that. I'm just going to church and blah, blah, blah. But actually, I feel like I should have done that. I should have listened to her. I should have listened to mum. As much as I've got a positive outcome, since I've got sperm, but I should have been more in line and been really fully within it.
So you saw it more as a time to be with God, and he will lead you where you need to go. You're in his hands, and that's the way it is. And
yeah,
that's interesting. And I think, like I said, there will be people out there that need to hear that. And it's important we talk about that because religion is a big part of many people's lives.
Yeah.
And when you throw something as fragile as infertility into it, you can only but ask the question internally. Thanks for being so open. I really do appreciate it, mate.
So in terms of advocacy, Jonathan, you've started sharing your story, which we're so grateful that you have. The more voices, the better. That's what's really going to change everything for men.
Yeah.
Where's your passion and mission leading you to?
I'm an ambassador for Fertility Alliance and working with Kate and Gwenda, continue to change the narrative around male fertility, fertility and infertility. So yeah, my advocacy, also working in my workplace. I work for Transport for London and I do talks. So we have a lot of police officers. I work with a lot of operations officers and I do 1 hour workshops at my workplace and just giving awareness around the fertility, speaking directly about my journey. It's changed people's outlook and mindsets around fertility. And the feedback I've got is listen to Jonathan's stories, help them, and not just fertility health, but sexual health and general health, just to look from the inside out. And also positive feedback. A lot of the women are finally, we've got guys who are talking about. That's been the most rewarding thing I've done because I'm not there looking for sympathy. I'm actually just there spreading awareness and just making other guys be aware of their fertility health.
What would you like to see more of?
I spoke about policy change. I thought about this recently and we're in a nation of stories. British people, we love a story. That's one thing I've learned. We love a story. So hearing other men talk about their story is empowering. And I feel as if policy, those that hold the keys or the cards to changing the policy, need to hear more men speaking about their story so they can allow them to change their mindset or, okay, let's help another man or let's help this couple, let's help a generation of men.
Yeah, definitely. There is a lot of work to be done, especially if you look at like a policy level. I always use the example of at 18, young women have to go and have their smear test, and then they have it regularly and things like that. But there's no physical test for men. Like,
yes.
Why at 21 aren't we? Even if it is, you just book into appointment, you go in, you have a physical at your GP. Every guy at the age of 21 should have that.
Yeah.
Minimum. And then if there's any concerns, you are guided down the right pathway.
Mm.
But then there's like the education, like how things online in terms of, well, check yourself. You've got to check yourself. You've got to do this. But how many guys are actually taught to do it? We're not taught to do it. I think as you get older, you become a bit more aware of your body and you might do it. But generally, like young lads aren't doing that kind of stuff. And it's because the education's not there. The policy's not there. The actual national guidance and support isn't there. The professionals aren't banging the drum as hard as they need to.
Yeah. And even for myself, the reason why I speak about it is because having had undesigned testicles at such a young age, I know obviously times have changed and they're checking boys thoroughly when they're born. That's what I've been told. When they're born, to check their testicles have dropped. I feel empowered to tell the story because, you know, when it's not just the 30 plus men who are trying to have kids, it's the 25-year-olds who are going to the gym and doing steroids. And
that's another big conversation. But you're right. You know, what the society norms that are actually damaging fertility among men. But this conversation proves that we're on the right track.
Yeah.
Jonathan, it's been a great conversation. And we'll definitely have you back at some point to maybe unpick a bit more about that education and cultural differences and things like that we can work on collaboratively.
Mm.
But we always finish with the same question, okay, every guest. And that question is, if you could give one bit of advice to a guy facing fertility challenges, what would it be?
Be honest with yourself. Be gentle with yourself. It's okay. If you're going through a rough time, you're going through a rough time. I'm no expert. I'm no psychologist. I'm no physiotherapist, but just accept things the way they are. Currently, work towards changing it if you can. Sean, you gave the Cool Runnings quote, but I have a quote, but I'm not too sure where it's from. But actually, one of my favorite quotes is actually, it goes, "I aspire to inspire before I expire."
Nice.
One of my favorite quotes.
Yeah. Quality. That's the thing. I think that's so important in life, is to try and leave this world a better place than when we came into it. And if everyone does that, then it helps everyone. And we find our way to do that. And you've definitely found yours. And like I said earlier, we're so grateful that you are here. You're doing it. You're a pioneer, essentially, because there's still very few of us, but we need more. And you're going to be inspiring others to do that. So thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favor and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at the Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.